Hi, it's time to enter the lesbian nation again. And if you remember last week, we heard the first part of a two-part interview with Marge Piercy, a feminist author who has just written a book called Small Changes. And tonight we're going to have the second part. One of the things that struck me about the book when I first read it was the language of the book. It was unlike any fiction that I've read. It spoke in the language that is my daily language, is the language of women who are struggling in the movement. And I felt that the book was, it's not about, say, the woman who gets married and moves to the suburbs and doesn't have a career, who just sort of moves straight out of college into a suburban marriage and never has had any feeling of what she wanted to do with her life, and then ends up wondering, you know, why she's got two kids and why she's bored. This is about women who are much more active and less passive in their lifestyles.
Or become so. Beth starts out getting married right from high school.
That's a little different. I'm thinking of all of the novels that I've read about women who've gotten, and I'm specifically saying college, because they tend to be more articulate but in a very different way. And better educated middle class, which Beth isn't. They seem to be, on the one hand, prevented from moving out of their little cages, but on the other hand, insulated from the kind of realities, at least for the time being, that Beth is up against. Beth is very much a working class girl who doesn't have the same, quite the same kind of romantic overlay and concepts of how to make a marriage work and so on that you get drilled into you when you're in college. More of a lip service commitment to egalitarianism.
That's more like Miriam's marriage when she finally gets around to getting married. About 25, she marries.
Right, and Beth gets married to a guy, you know, no nonsense. You do the wife role, I do the husband role, and that's that. He doesn't have any concept of what's going on with her sexually. I think that the middle-class male at least tries a little harder, or at least has heard a little bit more.
Well, sure, that's the scene when Jackson is trying to reform her sexually. That's the more the, you know, the hip male who's read the books and also who knows. His ego is bound up with satisfying a woman. Yeah, that's the difference there. Now, you've raised two things, if I can try to separate them out. They aren't really separatable out, maybe. One is who the novel is about. After the defeat of Marxist literary criticism, you know, like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, down with it went the attempt. Unfortunately, I'm not crazy about Marx's literary criticism, but unfortunately, with the defeat of it, went down. Novels about the reality of people other than the people who normally buy hardcover books, which is that white affluent society, the people for whom books are reviewed and who normally buy hardcover books. Remember Lionel Trilling talking sometime in the 40s about a novel of manners, which means literature interior, novels interior to the affluent, where the other people in society at best come in as, you know, subsidiary characters, comic relief, symbols. That writing about different sorts of people, as all of my novels have been about, other than that 10% of the population, you know, the other 90% of the population, is in itself a political act, or perceived as one. In other words, it's perceived as a political act to write about lesbians, to write about women who work in offices and taking them seriously. They aren't dumb secretaries; they're people. They're interesting people with interesting lives. All right. So who the book is about is one affront in a sense. It's the shabby Boston suburbs. I mean, that's the look, lady. That's where I lived. You know, and we're not talking about slums. What she's calling shabby is ordinary, working class, student, women alone, whatever. That's where people live who work.
I think if you had written about the ghetto, you see, novels about the ghetto at this point showing how gruesome and squalid everything is, are more acceptable from a certain point of view. Or sometimes non-novels, Man-Child in the Promised Land, for instance, to show a sort of a catalog of horrors, you know, taking dope at 14, knife fights and so on. It gives the middle-class reader a kind of vicarious thrill.
Well, in a sense, I suppose the Matt Waite, I mean, Phil does come from a public housing project in East Cambridge, but most of the characters come from, ordinary families, ordinary working class families, and I don't find the lives of people without money necessarily gruesome and squalid because they do not have money. That is one thing. I find the This reminds me, honestly, it reminds me back in college again. Once we were back in college again, and we're reading essays. There were a whole lot of Bilgi essays we had to read then about how tragedy had become obsolete because there weren't no kings no more. And, you know, like an ordinary person couldn't possibly have a tragedy. You could only have a tragedy if you had a title. And I found that stuff so loathsome then, and I find it so loathsome now that I cannot begin to communicate it. All right, that's one whole thing you're raising, which is who I write about and why my books must be squalid and dreary because they're about people that if you had a nice all white carpet on your living room floor, you wouldn't necessarily want in your living room. Like me, I undoubtedly spill the coffee. All right, number two is the language. That's the second issue. All right. I set out to unlearn the programming I had so painfully learned in college at one point in time. I set out to learn to write a language based, both in the poetry and in the fiction, though quite differently in both, on the spoken language. Now look, the language we speak is debased, is degraded, has been worn out, mangled, rotted by lies, by public lies. But it is the only language of the emotions that we have. The language that we speak in love, the language that we speak in anger, the language with which we speak to each other, it's where you have to start. If you speak to people in words that you learned in books, in very literary language, people think it sounds real nice and real pretty, and they know that it must be good because you had to get a degree to do it, but they also don't let it in. Doesn't sink in, it doesn't touch, it doesn't go down in the psyche, it doesn't change, it doesn't reach, it doesn't move.
And I know people who speak that way and who are very sincere and heartfelt about what they say, but they use the $5 words all too often.
It's not just a matter of $5 words, it's a matter of wanting to start with a spoken speech and not to write in it, because it is debased and degraded, but to use it as what one starts with, and to try to strengthen it, to try to purify it, to use it as well as one can, and thus make it better too, so that the language that we get back is a better language for one's having worked in it, you know? That's the only relationship I can see having with the language that comes through me.
Well, what I pick up from the characters in Small Changes is a great deal of effort, particularly on the part of Beth, and I see that most strongly in her, but I do see it at times in the other characters, to find exact ways of saying what's happening to her without falling into the kind of romanticized tripe and conventional ways we have of expressing our relationships and our feelings. And I see her trying so hard to say just precisely how she feels about something. And I know that at times I have made those efforts under a great deal of stress and difficulty in relationships with people. And I see other women, particularly in women's groups, trying to do that. Trying to cut out the conventional ways they have had of framing their feelings, because somehow our feelings have been debased. Our feelings have been channeled into conventions so that we respond automatically to certain kind of images and pressures from the culture. And I see people trying to change the way they respond, and you've got that in the novel. That really held my attention a lot. And I think that a lot of people react badly to that, too. The people who are used to fine writing, as you put it, that they react badly to the bald way, really bald way, in which Beth says this, that, and the other about the way she feels about someone. It's not romantic. I think that hurts people most of all. There's nothing romantic about the book.
Well, that's true. Undoing what romanticism had been programmed into me was the work of a number of years of my life. Unlearning all of that. And Beth is also unlearning it. Beth is almost killed by, you know, by her notions about love and marriage. And she understands she hasn't got much space to survive in the society. She isn't articulate. She learns to be able to say the things that she has to say. But it is hard. She's given so little, in a way, so little space. I was just thinking. I think that, in some way, women who identify with Beth like the book better than women who identify with Miriam.
Do you know that, strangely enough, I identified with Miriam much more than Beth, in spite of the fact that Miriam's the heterosexual one, more or less, and does things that I would never do. I found myself much more identifying with her.
Oh, well, she comes from Brooklyn, that's why. But you just blew my theory. Oh, and my instant theory about who...
What I couldn't identify with in Beth, and I said that when I wrote a little something about the book, was the asceticism that she goes through. I have never been able to be that. I have often envied people that, because I feel I would get more work done if I could do that.
I did it for 8 months. I had, 8 months of asceticism, yeah! At one point in the women's movement, when I just... my own sexuality, everybody's sexuality, just turned me off cold. And I just didn't want to deal with anybody that way at all. So I can understand it in Beth. But it wasn't very good for me. It wasn't a good state for me as it is for Beth. It was too much a splitting between the different parts of me. I wasn't as deeply in touch with what goes on in me as I need to be. But for different people, it's different, and I respect that choice, and I respect it in Beth, for whom it is, for a couple of years, a viable choice in her life, in the book.
Well, I can't do it on any level. Like, she is not only ascetic and sexually, she goes vegetarian, she works very hard, channels all her energy. Every time I've done that in one particular aspect of my life, everything else just sort of goes to pot.
Well, perhaps one of the reasons you were able to identify with Miriam and not react negatively to the course of her life is that you didn't identify with the kind of choices she made. One of the reviewers, I think the one in the New York Times, was very upset because of what happens to her. Yet the choices that she makes when she gets sort of freaked out by her life and what's happening to her and the part she's been playing in the male sexual revolution, and she makes what looks to her like a good marriage that is going to take her out of that ragged war she's losing. Now, how many women have you known who've made that choice, who thought that that's what they were getting, not seeing, in fact, what roles they were marrying into?
What do you mean? I mean, I feel like I've known a number of women who have gotten into marriages that were similar.
Yeah, but the way that the book has been reviewed so far, you'd think that nobody had ever before seen a woman, a bright, attractive, very, very able, very alive woman who gets married and then, in a few years has a few kids and is stuck at home with them and begins to, to diminish in her person, in what she can do in her life. Now, Miriam doesn't really diminish. I mean, she begins to grow out again with the help of the other women. But you'd think from the reviews this book had gotten that nobody had ever seen this happen to a woman. Yet I think about the women I went to college with, and I make you a list of 50 that that went that way, and most of them didn't get a second chance like Miriam does.
Yeah, I know, like, dozens of them in New York.
I know that the novel is a disturbing novel, it touches on a lot of things which are troubling. I believe that a good novel does this. For instance, in Miriam, one of the things that I know you mentioned to me was the picture of Miriam in her work situation. Miriam is, for much of the novel, a woman who has made, is making a successful career in a predominantly male field. Computer software, computer programming. She's good. It isn't easy for her to find a good job, but she does find one. Now, one of the things that happens is that she begins to understand the world in which she's working and to see that male world, that world which is so tied into the military-industrial complex, that her work is tainted, and she begins to perceive it that way. It's impossible, finally, to look at the professions. You know, we want women in the professions, but it's impossible to ignore what's done with the professions in the society, what in fact is the end of work, you know.
Well, one of the things that you bring out in the novel, although not a great deal of emphasis is laid on it, is that part of the motivation that leads Miriam to get into that marriage, to stay away from the job, is her consciousness of how tainted her work is and how much the work she is doing is involved with the military-industrial complex. At one point, I remember her saying something about it's better to be baking bread and raising babies than doing that.
It's her daughter that she feels is better. That how can anyone say that it isn't better to put energy into her daughter? And if you phrase the thing that way, and life is the child, and death is the work, then, you know, you end up at home. It's just that the way that she phrases the problem, it's like when she's trying to get out of the house. It's a choice between hiring somebody who isn't going to love her daughter to be with her, you know, like she thinks it was like hiring someone to take care of a dog, or giving all of her time and all of her energies to raising her daughter. Now, if you set it up that way and those are the options, well, you've answered your question.
Right, but what I was thinking was a different question, which was, I think that one of the motivations that went into her situation was her political beliefs helped pull her out of the job market, or she let them help pull her out of the job market and into just being homebound. You know, when I remember throughout my college and post-college years feeling very disturbed, not just about the obstacles against my success in the business world, but also feeling that I wanted to do something that I felt was useful. I went to work for the welfare department for a while because I sort of let myself think, well, maybe I could do something useful there, and then found out just how bad that was. But I didn't want to do something that I couldn't feel good about. And I think that that's a factor in Miriam that I could identify with very much. It isn't the most overwhelming factor, but it's really important to her. And I don't think people take that seriously enough.
Yeah, I haven't seen anybody talk about that part of the book besides you. Yet it is an important part of the book. It's an important part of her life. In a sense, the ability to choose to have a baby and stay home, you know, is an available way of opting out of the whole problem of how she's going to do meaningful work. And then later on, she's got the same problem. You know, when finally she can't stay home, she's going to have to go back to work. And then she finally has to solve that problem. But often that represents, just as people have babies in this society when the marriage is going bad, women have babies when the work is going bad, when they're blocked, some stymied in their engagement with the world. That's a way you can not do that and do something else. And it becomes you know, your thing to do. Well, meaningful work is one of the concerns in the book, and the Beth and her succession of dead-end jobs where she feels her life is being stolen from her, you know, in 8-hour segments, drearily not for her use. Doreen, who moves out of the same situation in a different direction. I mean, in fact, I suppose that's another way in which the book is different, and in which when people, you know, say it as in the misery, he's not sculpted, they mean all this stuff is left in. Like, it isn't just about the love relationships, which is a traditional matter of women's books, and that's an important facet of it. So is work. So is how people live. You know, like the whole chapter about how the women's house allots out work and just makes decisions. I consider that very interesting. I don't consider that the garbage of life, you know, that should have been sculpted out of there. That's the stuff of life. It's the stuff of my fiction, is those kind of decisions. Those kind of decisions are profoundly interesting to me. They are as interesting as who sleeps with who, if not maybe more so in the long run, you know, day in and day out. Furthermore, there is a lot of the book which is concerned about friendships between women. Which, as Virginia Woolf pointed out a long time ago, is something that's been totally missing from fiction. In part, that's because, you know, when we proclaim sisterhood, we're creating it. We're not proclaiming it because it's been there all along, and we just were too stupid to overlook it. Truly, it's something that we discover by creating. Women, in fact, have been each other's enemies.
It's the first novel about women who are political, whose concerns extend beyond their family life, that I've seen in American fiction. Okay, Doris Lessing does it. Doris Lessing does it over in Europe. The middle class and upper middle class, university-educated women who are involved with the Communist Party, or Simone de Beauvoir's involvement, or the partisans and so on, are reasonably common characters in European fiction, but have never existed before, to my knowledge, in American fiction.
I think that there are more forerunners than we may know about that have been sort of buried historically. I know that Agnes Smedley wrote Daughter of Earth, that the Feminist Press brought out recently, which is an autobiographical novel about growing up. I believe she came from some kind of Western mining family, and her life trying to survive and becoming very political and very politically active. Further, there's a much earlier thing that Feminist Press also brought out, Life in the Iron Mills by Rebecca Harding Davis, so that's primarily about men.
What I've seen thus far have been books that describe people in political movements, whether the books are by men or by women, and mostly they have been by men, where the women are generally secondary, get into the thing because their husbands and boyfriends are in, but rarely in American fiction, or possibly, well, almost never, has there been a book about a woman who was independently involved in politics.
That's true enough. I remember Harvey Suedos' book, Standing Fast, that I found fascinating, but was really upset by the treatment of the women in it. It followed a group of people on the left, which amounted to men. I mean, there are women characters in it, but you never know why they're doing what they're doing, really, and they're not. They sort of go along. And I remember feeling, you know, so left out of that book. I mean, I wanted to know what the women have been doing, because in point of fact, every place I've ever been on the left, the women were doing an awful lot of the work, the real work, not making the big speeches. Well, I said that in the Grand Coulee Dam. You know, the real work that makes organizations go on. Or that does outreach to people.
Yeah, and there weren't that many books. The books that were written about the first feminist movement, the suffragist movement, which is what it became, have been mostly historical, autobiographical accounts, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton's account of her life, but rarely fiction, and certainly not from the point of view of those women. They were really sometimes fairly reticent about their personal lives, not having come to the feeling of the personal is political that has been one of the really important insights of the women's movement of this century.
Well, I think some of that understanding was there, but that, in a sense, that faction lost. And there was over time, a decision by the more important organizations to focus on the more respectable demands, the changes in law and suffrage. I think that, you know, a number of radical feminists then did make links between the organization of the means of production and reproduction in Shulamith Firestone Stern and the content of sexual lives, but the...
Victoria Woodhull.
Well, a number of women did, but anyhow, what I want to say is, I think a lot of the insight was there then. We don't know how much got lost, how much couldn't get published, how much is buried in attics, how much got burnt by irate husbands or the descendants, how much got changed in being published, like changing of pronouns in Emily Dickinson or whatever, you know. We don't know yet how much history got destroyed and how many works of art were lost. I sometimes get the feeling that also of just generations of women who did... who, like, wrote poems or wrote fiction and put it away in a drawer and never took it out, who hid it, fearing success, fearing judgment, as much as fearing failure, as much as fearing isolation. So we don't know that. I think that that fiction has a use in writing about something like this that autobiography can't. Things happen... In fiction, the arc of actions is completed in fiction, as it isn't in life. You can have a kind of clarity about 10 years in the lives of people in fiction that you can't have in your own life, ever. You control the causal factors. You shape the narrative to stress what one believes to be. The most important part of it, so that it can be seen. The book has a lot of reality in it, not in the sense that they say when they say it isn't sufficiently processed reality. I think it's quite processed. It just isn't. It's processed in a different way according to different criteria, and that is where the rub, where it rubs. I know, in a way, it's a kind of arrogance, but it's at least an honest arrogance of someone working, in the language, that I do want to reach a lot of women. I want desperately for the book to get out to a lot of women. When I call the book of poetry to be of use, there's a kind of arrogance in that, but in a sense, not so much. It's the utility of a vase which carries water, but... which was made to carry water, not made to be stuck in a museum, made to carry water, but which is beautiful too, beautiful as much because useful as it is in addition to being useful. I could read that poem. It's the title poem in the November book, To Be of Use. The people I love the best jump into work head first without dallying in the shallows and swim off with sure strokes almost out of sight. They seem to become natives of that element, the black, sleek heads of seals bouncing like half-submerged balls. I love people who harness themselves, an ox to a heavy cart, who pull like water buffalo with massive patience, who strain in the mud and the muck to move things forward, who do what has to be done again and again. I want to be with people who submerge in the task, who go into the fields to harvest and work in a row and pass the bags along, who stand in the line and haul in their places, who are not parlor generals and field deserters, but move in a common rhythm when the food must come in or the fire be put out. The work of the world is common as mud. Botched, it smears the hands, crumbles to dust. But the thing worth doing well done has a shape that satisfies clean and evident. Greek amphoras for wine or oil, Hopi vases that held corn are put in museums, but you know they were made to be used.
The pitcher cries for water to carry and a person for work that is real.
This has been Lesbian Nation. I'm Martha Shelley. Good night.